Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Hey there, all you lovely listeners. Let's dive into this latest release that is going to suck the life out of you in the best way possible. So listen up, because the Womanizer Next 3D Pleasure Air Stimulator, available from Pink Cherry, takes pleasure to a whole new dimension. Literally. Imagine taking the speed and intensity of the original groundbreaking Pleasure Air technology combined with new climax control so you can control even the depth of the airwaves. The 3D Pleasure Air technology offers a deeper, richer sensation that might just transport you to a another universe of pleasure. The Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry, is the only toy that allows you to take complete control of your orgasm journey with fully customizable speeds, intensities, and depths. Made from soft touch silicone, a fully waterproof body, and smart silence technology, you can enjoy pleasure anywhere, anytime. So what are you waiting for? Ditch the dull and enjoy unparalleled pleasure from the Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry. Visit pinkcherry.com and save an extra 20% off with code NEXT.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I am a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a battery hen, and I love films. As Emily Dickinson once said, "If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain," which is why I don't let any watch Jessie's song in Toy Story 2. Profound words as always from Emily D there. Every week I invite a special guest over, I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Ricky Gervais, Jameela Jamil, and even Ed Gamble. But this week, my very special guest is superstar director, writer, radio DJ, podcast, double act, hero, man, the wonderful, the only, Mr. Joe Cornish. Announcement, listen up. On December 19th at the BFI in London, I will be doing a very special live end-of-decade show with Nish Kumar, where we will be breaking down the decade in film. We'll be discussing the films that made us cry the most, the films that made us scared the most, and the film that gave us the troublingest bonerists in the last 10 years. You can come along, you can bring your own answers, you can have a drink with us, and at the end, we might even do a Muppet Christmas Carol sing-along. Don't miss it. Tickets are available at the BFI website and they are selling fast. Get on that. If you do enjoy the show and you want to support it and get more content, you can also come and join me at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get extra guest questions for nearly all the episodes. You get some videos, guest list tickets to these live shows, you get recommendations, you get all sorts of shit. And this week, there's a 30 minutes of extra stuff with Joe Cornish where we talk about a secret plan to make him a massive movie star. It's gold. You don't want to miss it. Give it a look over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Oh, and one final announcement, because it is Christmas coming up. If you go to podcastmerch.co.uk/films to be buried with, you can, like my own mother, get your own troubling boner hoodie, cap, baby bib, t-shirt, anything you like. They don't all just say that. Some of them say things a bit classier. Have a look at podcastmerch.co.uk/films to be buried with. Imagine getting your nan for Christmas a nice warm hoodie that says troubling boners, worrying wideons. I mean, that's the gift that keeps on giving. So here we go. Joe Cornish. Come on. I mean, he has been a hero of mine for years and years. You know him. We all know him. The Adam and Joe show was a huge part of my life and it was a genuine inspiration. They were the pioneers of just get on with it and make your own shit. And for that, I will always love them. Joe went on to become a proper, amazing, brilliant, inspiring film director. And I've wanted to talk to him for years. And because of the magic of social media, people say it's bad and it is bad, but also sometimes it brings people together. There was a woman who is a fan of Joe, got in touch with him, said, "You must do Brett's podcast." He said, "Yeah, all right." I got in touch with him. Thanks to that woman. I turn up at his house, invited for the record. He just had a bebe, invited me into a house, met his partner, met his lovely bebe, went down to his room, screening room. We'll talk about that on the podcast. Anyway, we had a lovely time. It was amazing. And it's quite a long one, I think, but I think that you will enjoy it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 71 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an actor, a writer,
yes,
a podcaster,
yes,
a radio DJ, a human, a man, a megastar, one half of everyone's favourite double act, a toy manipulator, a husband, a father.
Not married.
Not married, so scrap that.
Yeah.
And
a partner.
He's a partner. Doesn't believe in marriage.
Like in the Wild West.
He's got a Wild West partner that he goes on adventures with. And one of the finest British filmmakers working today.
Oh.
Please welcome to the show, Mr. Joe Cornish.
Hey, you're very kind, Brett. That was one heck of an introduction. I think we should just call it a day.
Okay, thank you. Thank you,
sir. Because it'll be downhill from that generous hyperbolic spiel.
Joe Cornish, I'm in your house. I'm quite frankly, like, this is the dream. I'm in a room. Let me describe it. It's under the house. Not massive. Listen, it's not ostentatious.
No.
But what it is a fucking screening room. It's got a sofa. It's got a projector. It's got a proper screen against the wall. And some of the best. I mean, I feel like your DVD collection is for me. He's got Don't Look Now massively displayed.
Well, this is the shelf that Brett's looking at.
Yeah.
Is the stuff that's in play. Do you know what I mean? The stuff that I'm...
Yeah.
Thinking about watching, so if I come down here in the evening, that'll be my mini perusal section.
How often?
Whereas the main,
the main selection,
the Smithsonian, is in the little cubicle
behind us. Locked behind some double doors.
And to be honest, I've rationalised quite, because both Adam and I used to have, I mean, you probably did as well. Many people did in the 90s, thousands of DVDs, like thousands. But what with the new landscape of streaming and stuff, I figure you get rid of the ones that you know will be there forever on streaming. If it's a big studio movie that you feel, you know, that you like, but you're not necessarily passionate about.
Do you need three copies of Independence Day?
Exactly. There'll be copies of Independence Day available in landfill forever to be dug up.
Yeah.
So I've whittled it down to stuff that I think is really precious or stuff that I... covet or stuff that I think will disappear from the streaming libraries that might be hard to find in streaming libraries, because however good it is, streaming's still a bit unstable, isn't it? If your Wi-Fi goes out or something chokes your bandwidth.
I mean, what if one day the internet like stops?
Right,
then we're all fucked.
We're all fucked. So you've got to have a backup library of. And I have to say they are mostly Blu-rays. And I've got quite a lot of 4K discs as well.
The question I have for you is, how are you putting those DVDs on the shelf? Alphabetized?
Well, this happened about a year and... No, this happened after I moved into this house, which is only like a year and a half ago. I decided to go for label.
Right.
So all the Criterions are together, all the Eurekas are together, all the Twilight Times are together, all the, is it called Kino Lorber? Lorber?
Yeah, could be.
I don't know how to say it. I've never said it out loud. They're all together. All the Warner Brothers are together.
Wow, you respect a studio.
Well, I just like the uniformity of the spine.
The visual, you like
Yeah, because I like all the titles are justified left.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's as if it's as if my library is on a final draft or pages and I've lassoed it and justified left with all the titles. Within,
I mean, it is beautiful.
It's not beautiful, but it's pleasing. It is beautiful. It is pleasing. To you and I, it is beautiful.
And you're right. If you'd done it in alphabetical order, it would be a fucking mess.
It would be a fucking mess.
Visual man.
Yeah, well, thanks, man. I appreciate you appreciating my nutty room.
Joe Cornish, I have a confession, and it's something I'm not proud of, and it is this. I did not manage to see The Kid Who Would Be King at the cinema. And the only reason was because I was not in the right country when it came out. Was in
You're a busy man, that's fine.
Came out, I was in England and then I was in America when like each release I missed.
You deliberately avoided it.
Yeah, I flew across the Atlantic.
To get the fuck out.
I was like, when's it coming out? Book me a ticket. Anyway.
Very sensible.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
What I did do is I have watched it. I just haven't watched it on the big screen at the cinema. I apologise for that.
Well,
because I know that's how it was intended. But I watched it on the biggest screen I could, and it is excellent.
Oh, thank you.
I watched it very recently. I'm so interested in your filmography because so much of it seems to be
for children. Of it.
Yeah, as in about children and an optimistic view of the future generation seems to be the link between Attack the Block and Kid Who Would Be King. Mm. And I wonder where that comes from in you, that that is your thing. Is that your thing or is it just...
I don't know. I've no idea.
Because you've only just had a baby. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I think I'm quite a happy person, quite an optimistic person, yes. And Attack the Block in particular was a reaction to downbeat, miserabilist British urban films.
Yeah.
And particularly British independent films, the sort of miserabilism that tends to sometimes masquerade as importance when you don't have much of a budget. And just the fact that I find movie going really pleasurable, and even like a really good depressing film, like Brazil is quite depressing.
Yeah.
It's the example that springs to mind, is really elevating and transporting at the same time. And sometimes I find movies are just sort of grim for the sake of having a bit of impact, you know?
So anyway, I agree on that.
I wanted it to be upbeat. And it was a response to more negative and pessimistic portrayals of youth. And plus it was a sci-fi action-adventure movie, essentially. Yeah. So usually the good guys win.
Yeah.
Or if it's a sort of slightly dystopic sci-fi, there's a sort of plus-minus ending.
Yeah.
Where to one degree it's a positive and to other degrees it's a negative. And that's the case in Attack the Block. You know, lots of his friends have died and terrible things have happened and he's being... this is a spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. He's being taken away in a police van, but yet there's something within his personal development that where he smiles and he's got the support of the crowd. So it's
and he's on his way to being Star Wars.
And exactly, he's on his way to meet JJ.
Yeah.
And then Kid Who Would Be King is just an unashamedly kids film.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's good to be happy when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And an adult. I guess a lot of my favourite films, I mean, like everybody, a lot of my formative movie-going experiences were as a child.
Yeah.
And so kids' films had a big impact on me when I was a kid. And then also, as you get older, when I watch films about children, like Au revoir les enfants or The 400 Blows or classic European films about childhood.
Yeah.
When you watch those as a slightly older teenager, you suddenly have a perspective on childhood. It's the first age you are where you actually have a sort of intellectual perspective on being on that state of existence. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Do you remember feeling very nostalgic about your own childhood when you were in your late teens?
I genuinely remember being like in the last couple of weeks of school and feeling sad, like, oh, I'm going to miss it. I'm aware that this is a great fucking time and that I'm about to go into a thing which won't be like this anymore ever again.
And culture tells you that childhood is precious. Yeah. The way your parents respond to you as you grow up tells you that you're moving away from something quite particular and unique and important. Yeah. And so I suppose I was conscious of that when I sort of matured in my film tastes a bit when I was a late teenager and watched more European stuff. And a lot of classic European cinema happens to be, you know, there are a lot of great coming-of-age movies.
Is it because we like origin stories? Because all the best superhero films are origin stories, and childhood is an origin story.
Well, it's a weird phrase, origin story, isn't it? And it's only become currency because of the number of serial movies.
Mm.
I mean, most movies are origin stories. Is Scarface an origin story?
Yes.
You know, I mean, the vast majority of is Casablanca an origin story? Citizen Kane is an origin story.
Yes.
Like, you could say that about a lot of movies where the character is born and in terms of their imaginative life dies within the time frame of a film. The only thing that's changed is film stories don't end.
Yeah.
And it's one of my pet theories about what I like in movies is that they end.
Yeah.
A story ends because when a story ends, you can think about it, walk away from it, let it resonate, percolate. If you know there's going to be 16 more movies, then you don't have that intellectual distance, do you?
No.
And it's weird. It's strangely like suitable for the time, I think, for these anxious times that narrative now doesn't end. Because everyone's in a state of anxiety where, when will Trump, when is all this shit going to be over? All these terrible political and social...
We're in a fucking franchise.
We're in a binge-watching series that's never-ending. And in the olden times, narratives used to end. You'd have closure. You'd think, well, that period of history of my life, that story is over and I can learn from it. But now all these narratives are just endlessly strung out in a way that's very anxiety-inducing, I think.
I really agree with that. You're right. Can I ask you this? I was going to ask you this before we recorded, and if you don't want to talk about it, absolutely fine.
Mm.
And I just won't even ask this question. Mm. Can we talk about what happened with Ant-Man?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, great.
No, I've talked about it a lot.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
What happened? And how do you feel now, please, if you don't mind sharing a bit?
Well, as you know, we worked on that movie for a very long time.
Yeah.
So it all started... I mean, there's a super long version of this, and I won't do the super long version of it. But to cut a long story short, we were working on it for so long that we really experienced the whole evolution of Marvel as a company. Mm. So we started when they were experimenting with superhero movies, when they were hiring Ang Lee, people like that, auteurs, to try and bring respect to this genre that was pretty much a kind of direct-to-video thing when they started out. And then while we were working on it, they found a formula. Favreau, really, with the first Iron Man, found a formula that worked. So by the time we actually came to make the movie, by the time Edgar was ready to make it, the way the company worked had completely changed. They'd invented the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Mm. They discovered the value of narrative continuity between the films. And Edgar and I had written a standalone movie.
With an ending? Did it have an ending?
It had an ending, and it had a slightly tricky... thief at the center of it.
Right.
It had a thief at the center of it. Scott Lang was a thief. Now, even in the comic books, he's a thief to save his sick daughter.
Right.
So they set the character in a place where, you know, all movies are usually about a good person doing a bad thing for a good reason.
Yeah.
And it depends how you calibrate that. Like in the comic books, he's doing a bad thing for a very good reason. His daughter's dying. So he needs to raise the money for her operation. In our version, that wasn't the case. He was... a thief, a petty thief, a criminal who over the course of the movie reformed himself.
Right.
It had a lot of the elements that are in the finished movie. You know, quite a bit of our stuff is still there.
Okay.
But that eventually made it wasn't Disney back then. That made the Marvel committee very nervous.
Right.
His criminality at the beginning. And then there was just stuff they wanted to shoehorn into the film that Edgar and I didn't feel fitted with what we'd written. The other thing that was happening was, at that time, there was something called the Marvel Creative Committee, who were above Kevin in the hierarchy of that company. And there was a tug of war going on between Kevin and them. And they were not really filmmakers. They were corporate overlords who looked after all sorts of aspects of merchandising and that didn't, you know, you don't necessarily put at the forefront of your thinking if you're a writer or director. And Kevin actually won that tug of war and took over from them after Ant-Man.
Oh, okay.
So there was politics involved, and then there was just the basic creative disagreements thing, and then the company changing very much. But it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, it was much less painful for me than it was for Edgar, because I was just so chuffed to be there.
Right.
And just, you know... bedazzled by everything that happened, whether it was positive or negative.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe I was part of this thing that was happening.
I guess, I know nothing about what really happened, you know, the real side of it. What I always imagined was that it must have been frustrating once Guardians of the Galaxy happened, because it felt like, and maybe it isn't true, but it felt like they went, okay, let's give someone a chance to do whatever they want. That probably isn't quite what it was. But at the time of your Ant-Man thing, it seemed like they were on a track that was getting...
I don't know. I think it depends what sort of a director you are.
Right.
You know, Edgar's a writer-director.
Mm.
And you have a... You know, not that James Gunn isn't, but it just depends what sort of a director you are, whether you can...
Play well with others?
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, I think the Ant-Man thing happened so publicly that Marvel became aware that people... had this slight suspicion So yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe they worked to mitigate it in the way that they, or you know, going into Marvel after that point, you would have a knowledge of a certain need for accommodation, you know.
And do you like the film?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I do. That's good. Yes, I do. I do. There's still loads of our stuff in it, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
Loads of man. I'm just thrilled to see a line that I wrote.
Yeah.
On the screen, you know.
I saw a story.
Same with Tintin.
Yeah.
A lot of that is ours and a lot of it isn't ours. But when those characters say a joke or a line that I wrote in a Steven Spielberg film, it's all good as far as I'm concerned.
One more question, if I may. Oh, yeah. So my friend John Drever, who I made a film with, Super Bob, he wanted me to ask you. I said, I'm seeing you. I think you're his favourite. He couldn't believe I was coming.
Wow.
He nearly cried. And he said, can you please ask him about genre filmmaking in the UK? Is it because that's what he wants to do more of? And it's so hard. And I'm sure you have found it hard. And how do you feel about it now, at this point in your career?
I don't see why it should be hard, really. I think actually there's a real appetite to make a good genre film because they have a chance of making a reasonable amount of money. The tricky thing is that you've got so much competition, which was very evident with both Attack the Block and The Kid Who Would Be King, because as soon as you make an action-adventure sci-fi film or a big kids adventure film, you're immediately in competition with Hollywood movies that they market the living fuck out of. And that cost four times, you know, we had a good budget on Kid Who Would Be King, but it was a third of all the movies we were up against. We were an original movie with no real stars. Mm. Everything else was a franchise with massive public awareness already behind it. So that's the tough thing. If you make even a good genre movie over a certain budget, is that you're suddenly in very deep water in terms of who you're competing against. But if you can be clever about your idea and thinking of something that is visually novel but affordable, and you can do it convincingly, then I really don't see what should be holding people back in terms of going to companies and getting support. Because I think there's a lack of really good genre scripts out there, I think. That's the feel, I guess.
You're a bloody optimist.
Well, we've established that, haven't we?
Yeah.
I think
it's a real thing with you.
Yeah, I know. I think so. I think, especially if you're a writer, the truth is, and having sort of knocked around a bit now, that, that there aren't that many really good writers around.
Yeah.
And if you are good, I think you will get work.
Yeah.
So the thing is just to keep at it and keep working and keep improving.
Would you ever direct something you didn't write?
Well, yes, I think so. And I get sent stuff all the time. But, you know, Adam and I have been very spoilt. Like, we got our own TV show when we were 26 that we wrote, directed, lit, edited, starred in, literally shoved coat hangers up the actors, stuffed toys. So we've had this level of authorship from very early on. That has spoilt us a bit.
Yeah.
And there is nothing more satisfying than something that's completely come from your imagination.
Yeah.
Seeing it through to the end. I heard like Tarantino saying that about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when he was doing his press interviews for that, saying, you know, how rewarding it is because none of that shit would have existed. It all came from his brain.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's really, really satisfying. Plus, when you're on the floor directing, you've got real authority. You know it inside out and you can answer every single question
because
you've thought about it. It's from your heart, you know. You don't need to think about it, actually. You just immediately know whereas my worry would be if it was someone else's thing that you'd be second guessing a bit.
Yeah. Joe, I forgot to tell you something. And I probably should have told you when I got here. And it's bad because you've got your place and your kid and your life seems pretty great, but I probably just got to say it. I'm sorry, I should have fucking said it when I got here. Oh, it's hard to say it, fuck. You've died, you're dead. I'm so sorry.
Well, who are you to Tell me this. Are you the Grim Reaper?
I've been sent, yeah.
You've been sent by who? By whom?
Him upstairs.
The man, him upstairs.
Her upstairs, thank you.
Her upstairs.
How did you die?
Well, I've been thinking about this
because
I've listened to your podcast. And we had this, Adam and I had this friend called Chad, who was an American exchange student. And he had body hair and experience in the world long before we had it. He was an impressive figure. And he used to talk about what the most awful way to die was.
Yeah.
And he came up with this thing where he would say, okay, right, the worst way to die would be if you were in like a flume at a water park, one of those fiberglass tunnels. But it's in
you're in a water slide.
You're
in
a water slide tunnel. Lovely. Yeah. Okay. But it's at a quite an acute angle and it's infinite.
Oh, wow.
And you're sliding down it in your little swimming trunks.
Yeah.
And there's a razor in the very middle of it, bisecting it vertically, but it starts incrementally.
Yeah.
So your butt crack can't help but sit in it.
Yeah.
And then it very, very gradually gets taller and taller until at the bottom of the flume, it completely... And he said, and he used to say, and that's really stuck with me over all these years, he said, wouldn't that be a terrible way to go?
And that's what happened to you.
But actually thinking about it now, it might be a very sort of clean and pleasant way to go.
It sort of depends how quickly it's splitting you in half, I suppose.
But that's not how I want to go. That's just whenever people talk about, like, whenever the idea of inventing a death comes up, that's what I think of. I'd like to go,
I'd like to be at the bottom taking pictures for the, you know, when you get off a slide and there's, like, key chain pictures and stuff.
Of a perfectly bisected a bit like the guy in the lift in Damien Omen 2.
Yeah. Give it to the family
other
and good, a key chain.
What other good bisections in movies? There's lots but Baby Cart and the River Styx, is there a good one? Is there a good one in Itchy the Killer?
Probably.
Very, feels very like sharp knives. Done a few. And they sort of peel apart with little bits of sinew. Oh, lovely.
Lovely stuff.
Lovely stuff. Delicious.
How did you die?
I died like one of the vampires in one of Anne Rice's vampire novels.
How did they die?
Like the Vampire Lestat or Interview with the Vampire. So I've been alive for such a long time. I mean, I had a really good life as a mortal.
Great.
Then I got bit by a vampire.
Right.
When I was still sexy.
Yeah.
That age, you know, just perfect, little bit, like super sexy.
Mm-hmm.
I got bit. And then I lived for thousands of years, Brett, literally thousands of years, until I was so bored.
Yeah.
I'd done everything. I'd indulged because I'm a vampire.
How many of you were knocking about?
How many of me?
Yeah, how many, like, immortals?
I don't know. I don't care about the other vampires. It's all about me.
But everyone you know is dead, many generations.
Oh, yeah, no. Historical periods have gone by. I've seen the future. I've seen every permutation.
Okay.
I've travelled all over the world.
Yeah.
I've indulged my every nefarious whim.
Nice.
I've indulged my every altruistic whim. I've done it all.
Right.
The snag is, if I remember rightly in those novels, when a vampire dies, like if a vampire sucks another vampire's blood, they die.
Oh.
And it's incredibly painful. But by that point, I'd be so desperate for a new sensation that simply that level of pain would be very enjoyable. Refreshing.
The vampire that kills you, is it the same vampire that made you a vampire?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. It could be. Could be. That would be
it's
poetic.
Nice. Yeah.
That would be nice. That'd be nice.
That you've travelled the world trying to find him again. Yeah. Do you know his name?
It's Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
In his
or Brad Pitt, but in that outfit from Interview with the Vampire.
Does that film hold up?
I don't know. I haven't watched it for years, but I just like saying the, because everyone says I just like saying it and putting the emphasis on the word the. People go, what? With the vampire. I mean, I remember it being a touch wonky at the time, only because I'd read the novel and loved the novel.
Oh, yeah?
And the novel is a bit more out there than the book.
Hmm.
But I don't know. Man, I'm a sucker for Tom Cruise. I love Tom Cruise and
Tom Cruise.
Vampire teeth and a long wig. I'm in.
Put him in a wig.
Do you
worry about death?
He should run a wig shop and all the dummies in the window would be him.
Just his Mission Impossible peel-off face.
Yeah, exactly. The Born on the 4th of July. That's quite a scraggly
wig. That's a
good wig.
That's a great wig.
That's a great wig.
Did that win Oscar for best wig?
Is there an Oscar for best? Well, I guess hair and makeup is the Oscar. It should have done.
Hell of a wig.
That is a hell of a wig. Let's just, I think we should just have a, maybe a 40-minute silence just to think about that wig.
Tom Cruise's wig in Bourne. And it changes.
It's an angry wig.
Yeah.
It's a wig that's seen things.
It's a real Charlize Theron in Monster wig.
Yeah, it's through like, a hedge backwards.
I'm doing acting now.
Are you?
I'm going to wear a wig.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're quite an experienced actor, aren't you?
Yeah, and if I wear a wig, you know I'm serious. You know, this is, he's doing a serious part.
I look forward to that wig.
He's wearing a fucking wig.
Maybe sketch some on the way home. Okay. Start working on it.
Do you worry about death?
God, I don't know. I worry about it. Not that much, to be honest.
Okay.
That's not a very good answer, is it? Yes. Sounds like I haven't thought about it.
Sounds like I'm the first person to tell you it might happen.
Yeah, I don't know. There's not a lot you can do about it, is there? In fact, there was a piece in the paper, wasn't there, the other day about how human beings naturally don't think about it. We're wired somehow not to think about it because we can't calculate it. It's sort of nonsensical. Yeah. My thing is like, well, what was I doing before I was born?
Yeah.
Is that upsetting? Because that's just the equal and opposite. Like, am I really, is it a really abstract, difficult and painful notion to think that I wasn't around in the mid-60s? Not really.
Seemed like a torrid time.
It did seem like a torrid time.
A lot going on.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't, now that I've got a baby, a baby, I wouldn't want to clock out too soon. Thanks, mate.
Mm. Well done.
Cheers.
Is there an afterlife for you?
I really don't know. I don't think so. I don't know. Oh, is there for me? Like, do I?
What do you
believe? Yes, sure there is. Sure there is. Yeah, there is. There is. It's brilliant.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's great. It's absolutely, whatever it is, it's brilliant.
Filled with bebes?
Filled with bebes that have evolved in a way that makes their screams a bit quieter.
Okay.
Yeah. And they can talk and walk a lot earlier.
This is your first baby, right?
Sure. Baby number one.
Baby number one. More to come?
Isn't it a lot of fun?
Bit soon, isn't it?
Baby number one. Baby number one. Isn't it a lot of fun? Bit soon, bit late.
When you had the baby, this is a very personal question. I'm going to ask it. You don't have to
do it.
When that baby was born, first time, come out.
Yeah.
Come out wherever it came out.
Come out, baby.
Come out.
That's what the doctor said.
Seen the baby. Did you think immediately, oh, love, 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 I'll die for you? Or did you think, fucking hell, that's a baby?
Have you got a baby?
No, but I always think, what
would that moment? Did I think, fucking hell, that's a baby?
Like I said.
Well, that would be the sort of thing I'd think if I didn't think it was going to be a baby. I thought you were going to give birth to a melon. Or maybe a monkey, or perhaps another cat.
It's just like you said, Doctor.
It's a bear. It's a bear bear.
Like, did you go, wow, shit? Or did you go, love, 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 love? This is scary.
Well, you know, newborn babies are a bit like finding a shrew in the garden. They're very vulnerable. And they can't really see.
Right.
And so you don't. And one of the things that freaks out parents for the first time is how sort of disconnected and vulnerable a newborn baby is.
Yeah.
So I was ready for that because I'd done a lot of reading and been to NCT classes.
Man.
But yeah, no, I did the crying and all that stuff. Yeah. It's pretty incredible, yeah. And now I walk around in the world. I'm quite an old guy to be having the first baby, so this is old news for everybody else. But I think that guy was a baby. I walked past someone in the street, like smoking a fag and really angry, and thought, oh, you were like you were all covered in blood and really completely vulnerable.
Couldn't see.
And properly. Somebody like really nurtured you, and this is what you ended up as.
Yeah.
No, it's just a weird thought, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that a lot. Well, that's good that you felt love and stuff.
I just had to check, I guess. Yeah. No, some people don't. Some people take a while. To get there, but yeah, I love my baby.
He loves the baby.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is, in a way, there is a heaven as predicted, but they're obsessed with film in this heaven. Obsessed with it.
Sounds like heaven to me.
Yeah, absolutely obsessed. There's screening rooms everywhere.
Are they bores?
The people? No, they're the right mix.
There are a lot of annoying critics there.
No critics. No critics.
Critics
allowed.
Aren't allowed into heaven. No.
Can you imagine?
All right.
They're in purgatory. They're in purgatory being made to make films that sometimes get sent upstairs.
Justice.
And we watch them and go, no thanks.
All right.
You're in heaven and they talk to you, but not in an annoying way. Like, they're open. They don't love British miserabilist cinema up there, which is good news, I think. Mm-hmm. but they want to know about your life, man. And they want to know about it through film. And the first thing they ask you is, what is the first film that you, Joseph Cornish, remember seeing?
It's going to be like, that's the question. What's the question the first film you remember seeing? Well, the Jungle Book at the, what's now the Brixton Academy.
Oh, really?
Used to be a cinema called the Astoria. And this was probably when I was three.
Really?
I just remember, because it's a huge auditorium, the Brixton Academy. It used to be a magnificent music hall.
Did you grow up in Brixton?
Yeah, well, here. I grew up in the house over the road.
Oh, wow.
So, and I remember sitting right at the very back of the circle watching The Jungle Book.
Wow.
And then there used to be a cinema in Stockwell where I saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
What?
And then Flash Gordon I saw there as well. Nice. Last Flight of Noah's Ark.
Do you remember the all of it, that Jungle Book experience?
No. I just have like a weird little, like, Terrence Malick-y nibble.
Beautiful woman looking down at you with light behind her head.
Somebody mumbling voice over.
Something about water. A lot of chat about water.
Walking on the beach. So that's the first. The first really impactful experience was. Then I used to go and see a lot of movies at the Disney Cinema. You know, there used to be a dedicated Disney Cinema in London.
No.
Where the Lumiere used to be in St. Martin's Lane. It's now a gym called Gym Box.
Right.
Boo. That used to be a beautiful cinema that used to show all Besson's films and Wings of Desire, beautiful big screen. Yeah. And before it was the Lumiere, it was a Disney cinema where they would just show Disney films all day. So they showed One of Our Dinosaurs Is Missing. And when you went down those stairs that you go down to get into Gym Box, they had the dinosaur from One of Our Dinosaurs Is Missing. So we used to go there a lot. My parents used to take me to the NFT that it was called a lot. Then my parents' friend Pamela took us to see Picnic at Hanging Rock, which was, I think, a U certificate.
Yeah, I believe so.
Or maybe an A. But we saw it age 7 and it freaked the living shit out of us.
What did A mean? All right.
A just meant, it meant all right. No, I think U is universal. A, maybe you had to be accompanied by an adult.
Okay.
U films toddlers can see on their own. They can, if they can
they
just
can get
do
the ticket.
Yeah, if they, one can learn to push another in a pram, then you see big groups of the under threes going in to see U's. It's fine.
Yeah, it's absolutely fine.
It's absolutely fine. But for A's, they need to be, you know, you need to have an adult. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. Actually, I can't remember what an A stood for. But anyway, it shouldn't have been an A because nothing visually shocking happens in Picnic at Hanging Rock, but the atmosphere and the music and the mood is terrifying. And it really.
A load of girls disappear.
Load of girls in lovely white frilly dresses disappear. Yeah, when they get going on a picnic to Hanging Rock in Australia. Mrs. Mangle from Neighbours is there.
Yeah.
Very famous actress in Australia. And then they all disappear and then it goes on and on with a court case and shit.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I've got brother and sister,
Older, younger?
Both older.
Close?
I'm the youngest. Close.
Yeah.
Yeah, sister's in Australia.
Uh-oh.
So not that
so
close.
Quite far.
And brother is, he's pretty close. We're pretty tight. He'll fuck you up if you cross me.
Okay, cool.
That's not true. He won't.
Did you
go
with them? He's a policeman.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah, he's quite high up in the policemen.
Is he?
Mm.
Is he crooked?
No. In fact, my brother was one of the inspirations for the lead character in Hot Fuzz.
No shit.
And one of the first people that Edgar and Simon interviewed for the character of Nick Angel was my brother.
Oh, wow.
So take from that what you will.
He's a good boy.
He's dedicated. A very good brother, and I love him very much.
Thank you.
That's a pleasure.
Did they go to the cinema with you, is my question.
Well, my brother came to see Picnic at Hanging Rock with me, But no, a lot. I guess we went as a family, like most families when we were young, but I did love to go on my own from a very young age. Great. I went to Streatham, the ABC and the Odeon.
Yeah.
Those were my two haunts. And I still do love going to the cinema on my own.
Me too.
I think it's the best way to do it. I saw Joker on my own yesterday.
Yeah, how did you find
it? Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I saw that on my own too.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like I saw the new Halloween
on
my own at the Arclight in Los Angeles.
Love that cinema.
It's a good cinema, but I did feel like somebody could creep up behind me and attack me at any moment. And I quite a few times I had to look over my shoulder to check that there wasn't a psycho.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And in LA,
there's a slight edge of terror always in LA.
Yeah.
Just because of the earth, the possibility of earthquakes.
Yeah.
And because everyone's in America's armed to the teeth. That's why they're so polite. That's why in America, if you're shopping and mm-hmm. someone crosses between you and the product, they go, excuse me. Because there'll be a gun battle.
Yeah.
If you're not polite.
Speaking of scary, what's the scariest film you ever seen?
Okay, so, you know, boring answer is, I think, the standard thing that a lot of people on this podcast say. And Jack Whitehall, I listened to his interview on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to suggest that a lot of people have friends who have VCRs.
Yeah.
And lax rules. And that happened to me. I had a friend called Jolyon Parsons, and we were 11, and we rented The Exorcist and Zombie Flesh Eaters and Fame. And
which order did you watch these in?
Well, I remember being really freaked out by Fame starts with an actor pretending to do a shit. Like, it's a medium close-up of an actor, and they're straining,
yeah.
I think. And that shocked me.
Yeah.
That person's doing a poo in a film.
Mm.
So maybe we started with Fame.
Jolyon, turn it off. Put on Zombie Flesh Eaters.
Put on Zombie Flesh Eaters. Oh, my God, that woman's eyes being impaled by a splinter. Take that off. Put on The Exorcist.
Must be something nice.
It was awful. I mean, it was a really sleepless... Mm. I didn't sleep that night. And in fact, I think it was the first time I'd ever stayed up all night, which is a very odd thing to do anyway, because you're aware of the weird metaphysical nature of existence.
Yeah.
What you mean, if I never went to sleep, I'd just be... the world would just be this weird continuum. I don't know. So I had a sleepless night. I saw the sun come up, and it was fucking horrible. Jolyon went to sleep, didn't give a shit. Water of a duck's back.
Not bothered by an actor
not
pretending
bothered
to
by
shit.
Young girls stabbing themselves with crucifixes.
Right.
But no, that was pretty grim. And then what else? Lots of really good VHSs, because I'm of that age where, you know, early 80s, no certification. My family never had a VCR, but I knew lots of kids who did. So I was slap bang the right age to be watching videos when there was no certification.
Nice.
So, you know, Damien Omen 2 was a big one in my scene of 10-year-olds. Frame Advancing, the guy being sliced in half in the lift, as mentioned earlier. Alien was big for us, The Exterminator,
mm-hmm.
Excalibur, Carrie. Yeah, so I got pretty scared. Faces of Death used to be going around.
Oh, my. I never watched
that. Monkey Brains and shit. Cujo, I went to when I was 13, and it was a double A. It was a 15.
Right.
Creepshow,
yeah.
I went to when I was about 13, and it was a 15. And the first episode of Creep, the first segment of Creepshow, George A. Romero's compilation horror film, is called The Crate. Wow. Do you remember that?
No.
It's just a sort of anthropologist who works in university who brings back a mysterious crate and leaves it in their lab, and you don't know what's in the crate, and what is in the crate just comes and kills everybody, like the janitor. I haven't seen it for a while, but that was particularly terrifying to me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Do you like being scared?
Yeah. I mean, I do like being scared, and I think, you know, a lot of it is chasing the strength of that, of the impact that those movies had when I was a little kid.
Both your films have horror elements in them.
Yes.
I'm very impressed with the, if I may say, and I sort of bring this up because I talk a lot on this podcast about not liking CGI. I was really impressed with it in Kiddy Will Be King. I thought your special effects were really...
Well, great. We worked really hard.
You look like it.
Have you done that sort of stuff in your work?
CGI stuff.
Yeah.
In Super Bob, there's 5 minutes of special effects.
And did you work with a big company to do it?
No, it was just one guy.
One guy. Tiny. And did you? And it's hard work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really weird
it's really
thing.
Hard.
Because they're huge companies full of very brilliant people, but it's extremely impersonal and it's very much an industry. So, I mean, all filmmaking is this weird junction between aesthetics and commerce, right? And an industry. But the special effects industry is a proper industry. It's too boring to go into, but I found it very much the toughest. And you have to push and push and push and push and make a real villain of yourself.
Really?
Yeah, and And when there's as many shots as there were in The Kid Who Would Be King,
nice.
And you've got a deadline and a limited amount of money, and you never meet the person who's doing the work.
Really?
You have a supervisor, and then it's Chinese whispers down to some man or woman in a room somewhere miles away. It's like ordering a picture to be painted over the phone to someone in India or something.
Pepperoni. It's got pepperoni on it.
Yeah, but if the pizza was extremely specific
and
you needed that piece of pepperoni in a very particular place, a particular size, a particular colour, a particular temperature, which is what you want. And then also each... Stop me when this is boring.
Not to me.
Each shot is an individual meal for the company, and it'll be done by a person that doesn't know what's in the shot before or later. And there'll be a supervisor whose job is to oversee that. But often the sheer number of shots is overwhelming for them, and no human being can possibly keep track of it.
Yeah.
So it's brutal.
Did you have it all mapped out to start with, sort of storyboard-wise?
It's less brutal, sorry to just steamroll your question, if you're on a franchise movie where the design is set in stone, where the design's in. A Star Wars movie, the vast majority are established, especially if you're inventing stuff from the ground up, then it can be very difficult. Sorry, what was your question?
I guess I'm assuming you had to like have it all mapped out storyboard-wise to start with. This.
Yeah, we do previs. So there's this great company called Third Floor who do sort of... I want to say N64, but it's actually come on from that. It's like sort of slightly primitive computer graphics versions of the sequences. And we had to start editing those action sequences while we were shooting The Kid Who Would Be King. So I'd come home, I'd come off the set, and I'd go into the editing room until about 11 p.m., then go back to the hotel, do a bunch of emails, then go to sleep for 5 hours, then get up and shoot again. Because you had to complete the sequences and get them into the effects pipeline in order to have them done on time for delivery. And you know, not to disparage the people at effects companies who work incredibly hard, you know, are like amazingly hard, because everything has effects now. Every TV series, like as an audience, our expectation of eye candy, even in, you know, episodic television, has rocketed in the last 10 years. So there's enormous demand on these companies, and they do amazing stuff. But yeah, it's a big managerial, and that's the thing that freaks me out as somebody who tries to be quite a nice person, is you have to, you reach a line where you have to be a bit assertive and a bit of an asshole in terms of just being persistent in order just to get it done to a standard.
How are you on set as a director? Are you really nice the whole time? Did you ever lose your temper?
Yeah, I lose my temper if I think something hasn't been thought through properly.
Right.
Or if something's been sloppily done.
Okay.
If there's loads of actors and everyone else on the set and a department is sort of letting the side down, that can be really not frustrating.
Can I ask what you're like when you lose your temper? Are you shouty?
I got shouty one time. but that was because of actually a safety thing on Kid Who Would Be King.
Right.
I thought somebody was doing something unsafe. But you're really not supposed to do that. Like, your job as a director, you have the first AD, you have a million people around you who you could just quietly, politely say, oh, would you...
Shout at everyone.
Would you do the shouting for me? Well, you know, that's what first ADs are brilliant at knowing how to handle that kind of thing whilst keeping everybody happy. But there one time I forgot to do that.
Right.
And in fact, the person that I shouted at just didn't turn up for work. I didn't shout at them, but the person I had stern words with didn't turn up for work the next day. Oh, he's gone to work on Detective Pikachu.
No.
Fair enough.
Oh,
but no, by and large, no, because it's such an enjoyable job. I love it.
Oh,
so I hope that by and large, I'm really happy and relaxed.
That's great.
So lucky to be doing it, don't you think?
I think that every day. Genuinely, I do. I think whenever, even when it's really stressful, I go, I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
Yeah, exactly. It's a privilege.
Yeah, huge.
Hey there, all you lovely listeners. Let's dive into this latest release that is going to suck the life out of you in the best way possible. So listen up, because the Womanizer Next 3D Pleasure Air Stimulator, available from Pink Cherry, takes pleasure to a whole new dimension. Literally. Imagine taking the speed and intensity of the original groundbreaking Pleasure Air technology combined with new Climax control, so you can control even the depth of the airwaves. The 3D Pleasure Air technology offers a deeper, richer sensation that might just transport you to another another universe of pleasure. The Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry, is the only toy that allows you to take complete control of your orgasm journey with fully customizable speeds, intensities, and depths. Made from soft touch silicone, a fully waterproof body, and smart silence technology, you can enjoy pleasure anywhere, anytime. So what are you waiting for? Ditch the dull and enjoy unparalleled pleasure from the Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry. Visit pinkcherry.com and save an extra 20% off with code NEXT.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
What is the film that made you cry the most? And are you a
cry? Well, yeah, I'm a cry. So ones that have made me cry recently, Shoplifters, The Creator.
I fucking loved that. Was my film.
Jeepers Creepers. I mean, we were in bits.
Yeah.
There's a movie called Summer 1993. It's really, really good. Little girl, her parents die. Mm. She goes to live with her aunt. And it's incredible performance. It is an incredible performance from this little girl and an even younger girl who have this sibling rivalry. And it just does a brilliant thing at the end that you don't know it's doing. And it does a thing at the end. It lets a character do something at the end that you didn't realize they hadn't done for the last hour and 20 minutes. And then they do it and you go, oh, my God. And
is
then,
he crying?
It could be.
Is it that she hasn't cried?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And then that was just like a fucking tap turned on for me. So that's really good. You know, yeah, I know I'm definitely a crier. E.T. as a kid, I know I'm not allowed to mention it, but I was bang on the right age for that movie.
Do you cry in life without films? Are you a crier?
Well, I used to cry at stuff like... what was that Cilla Black show where she made people's dreams come true?
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. I don't cry at funerals, but surprise, surprise really gets me.
Yeah.
Maybe that's okay. That's just healthy. That's just sort of diverse.
But it means, I think it...
emotion into a safe place.
That's it. I think I don't cry in life, but I cry at films and adverts.
Yeah.
But is that because I'm scared of other people in real life seeing me vulnerable?
Probably, Brett.
Yeah.
But you're one of us. You're a psychopath.
Yeah.
So welcome 100%. To the club. We've established that. 100%. But no, I loved. But I must say, European films I find easier to get emotional about, especially because the thing I love about them, and I used to love about them, is often you don't know the actors, so you believe.
Yeah.
You believe in. I personally believe in them more. I can believe the people are the people, and the artifice is less obvious if it's a European movie or a foreign movie.
What is the film that people hate? Generally, critically derided, but you're like, you idiots, this is the best film ever.
This is a tricky one. I don't like slagging off other people's work, whatever it is, because it's hard. Oh. It's a tedious truism, but it is true that to finish any movie.
Any movie being any good
film,
is a miracle.
Even a short film, even even getting your mates together and shooting a sketch is tough. To stay the course and finish it, just finishing stuff is tough.
Yeah.
But having said that...
This is a positive one.
This is the film that is supposed to be bad, but you love unashamedly.
Yeah.
So, Siegfried and Roy's Magic Box. Have you ever seen Siegfried and Roy's Magic Box?
No.
Have you thought about Siegfried and Roy's and their Magic Box?
No, but now you put it in my head, it's all I will think about.
Would you put your hand in it? No. So this is a film that they made. It's an IMAX film. And me and my partner, Annabelle, and a bunch of friends went to see it at the IMAX in New York. We were high on grade B drugs.
Nice.
And I think it was in 3D. I can't remember because everything's in 3D, really.
Yeah.
So it was either just a continuity of 3D-ness. You don't like, it was in 2D. Mm. Like, I walked in the cinema, everything was in 3D. The film started. It's fucking 2D.
This is so flat.
This is bullshit. No, I think it might have been in 3D, and it tells the story of Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah.
Siegfried discovers a magic book in a merchant's window, so it starts off dramatized.
Yeah.
It's very camp. he desires it as a means to solve his problems with his father at home. Young Siegfried is wearing lederhosen through the whole opening of this film. It's narrated by Anthony Hopkins. Young Roy, meanwhile, spends time at the Bremen Zoo and eventually liberates Chico the cheetah.
I was going to say something filthy then, but I stopped myself.
Never talk to yourself.
He takes a cruise ship bound for New York, where he meets Siegfried, the resident magician, and joins his act. It's the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. It's very spectacular.
Sounds wonderful.
It's incredibly wrong, and I loved it.
What's in the magic box, or is that spoiling? Would that spoil
Siegfried's cock?
Okay.
Or Roy's cock, I don't know.
Can't tell the difference.
Yeah, no, that's well, not one of them's wearing Lederhosen. It's full of magic.
Yeah.
It's full of magic. It's absolutely stuffed full of magic.
That sounds great.
It's really good. And the thing is, it's never... I don't think it's ever been... I sometimes fantasize about hiring the BFI IMAX and showing it. But I don't know whether there's a print that exists anymore. I've got it on DVD.
Have you?
But to recreate, you know, an IMAX print of it.
Yeah.
In an IMAX. Because I doubt it's screened that regularly.
Yeah. You're the first time I've heard of it, and it sounds wonderful.
It isn't. it is.
If we can be slightly negative, what's a film that you used to love, but you've watched it recently and you're like, I don't like this anymore? But it might not be because it's bad. It might be because your feelings of the world have changed.
Well, my answer to this is movies that I've just rinsed.
Yeah, that's fair.
That I've seen so many times.
Yeah.
I'm almost like, I don't know what I'm watching anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm watching. I just, like, so Superman 2.
Okay.
I watched recently Projected, and it turned that corner.
Right.
Like, all I could see were the joins. Mm. And plus, I know a lot more about filmmaking than I did when I was a child and saw it, so I was starting to see just the complete artifice of it. Plus, the editing rhythms are very dated now. Mm-hmm. The speed of the story being told, just a lot of it's very dated. So Superman 2, Flash Gordon, I've seen that movie so many times. It's almost just like, I don't know what it's like running a bath or something. I don't know. And then the other category I would say is problematic movies like Manhattan.
Yeah.
Is odd to watch now, Just One of the Guys. 16 Candles with Long Duck Dong.
Yeah.
Where there's a gong sound every time he appears. Soul Man with C. Thomas Howell.
Soul Man.
Like, so there's a whole... Yeah. Those are the two categories that I would refer to as an answer to your question. Movies that I've rinsed, and movies that just time has changed one's perspective on.
I think that's it. I think that's a fair and kind answer.
Yeah.
What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily because the film itself is any good, but because of the memory you have around the experience of seeing that film. Could have been a first date. Could have been the day you got a job. Could have been the day your bebe was born.
My bebe. I've got four choices, okay? You can choose.
Okay, I will.
Close Encounters, The Black Stallion, Die Hard, or Au revoir les enfants.
And there's all a story attached to all four of them.
Yeah, they're not very good. Well, Close Encounters, my Uncle Simon... was the art editor of the Bufora magazine, the British ufology magazine.
Really?
Yeah, which is an amazing magazine. I've got boxes of back issues somewhere in the garage full of all these sketches of alien encounters and aliens. And at that time, I didn't know they weren't real. My mum used to take me to the Brixton Library, and I found as a kid on the shelf a reference book full of alien encounters. It was in the reference section of the library. Yeah. So as far as I was concerned, this was something I had to prepare for. It was very likely that I would meet an alien. You know, my uncle did this as a professional endeavour. So he took me to see it. But I think the Odeon Haymarket that's gone now. So that, and it was, like, it's a good film. I don't know whether you've seen it.
Close Encounters?
Yeah.
I love Close Encounters.
Yeah, it's really good, isn't it?
I watched it recently at the Open Air Theatre as well. I love it so much. I think it's one.
Which Open Air Theatre?
You know, the one where they do in Hyde Park?
Oh, yeah.
They did a screening. We watched it in the rain.
It's really good.
I think I'm obsessed with it because I say this and then we go back to it. But, what I don't like about it is that Steven Spielberg says he wouldn't do this anymore.
Yeah.
But I really think it's interesting that the dad leaves his family for his obsession. And Steven Spielberg says, I would never have a character do that now. And I'm like, but that's what makes the film so... complicated and brilliant.
Yeah,
I love that film. Anyway,
and it's got moments of domestic drama,
incredible,
that are, you know, and it's no coincidence that Truffaut's in it. But there's the divorce stuff is to have a movie with that stuff and then also the kind of psychedelic rock concert stuff.
Yeah, love it.
Is quite something.
Baby crying.
So anyway, that was just a particularly impactful, and it terrified me. Plus, a bunch of my family live in Devon, and we used to go there on a holiday, and a lot of them said they'd seen UFOs.
Really?
Or ball lightning. There was a UFO story about a UFO drifting across the fields behind my grandmother's house and dipping over the hedges. She swore she'd seen it. So, and you know what? Have you ever been to Devon?
I think I have.
It gets very dark there, particularly in North Devon.
Okay.
It's like one of those special places where you can still see, you know, there's no ambient light. The dark is absolutely pure black, the sort of pure black that my Sony projector struggles to hit. it was very frightening and very impactful. Plus, you don't know how films are made, right, when you're that age. Like, no. As far as I was concerned, this shit just happened.
It was a documentary.
And someone was lucky enough to... You don't really notice edits, do you, when you're a kid? It just seamlessly flows. So, yeah, that was frightening.
What? Oh, here we go. Here we bloody
sexy
go.
Sexy time.
It's sexy time, Joe. Let's get
not
comfortable.
Again.
Let's put on a horror film and get comfortable. What is the sexiest film you've ever seen?
So I've got a few for you here.
Great.
I mean, Ornella Muti in Flash Gordon is insanely sexy.
Yeah.
I mean, just insane in that outfit.
Yeah.
And she is a generally very attractive lady. I have a good friend who was a child actor who played her son. And had to do a scene where he was in bed with her as mother and son. And he didn't have very, well, you know, there was eatable shit going on in that scene. She's also, if you're a fan of Ornella Muti and her beauty.
There's
a movie called The Most Beautiful Wife, an Italian film that I highly recommend, about in which she's 15. So you admire her aesthetic beauty. And she's the daughter. She's basically the most beautiful girl in the village. It's Italy and it's the 70s.
Okay,
things are different. Fine. The son of the mafia boss,
his
father dies. He's a bit of a loose cannon. He says, I'm marrying her. And he's never been told no to anything in his life. And she says, no. That's Italian for no. No. And he won't take no for an answer. That's all I'll give you. But it's fucking good, Brit.
That's the same setup as Beauty and the Beast.
I did that voice. Is it?
Yeah. Gaston's like, I'm Marion Bell. And she's like, no, which is English for no.
Well, I think the ending's different.
Right.
That's all I'll say.
Okay.
The opening titles of The Spy Who Loved Me. So they are...
They're
very sexy. And there's a story behind that in that they finished it. What's his name? Who designed all those things?
Saul Bass, is it?
No. Come on. He's a famous designer. His name escapes me. But they finished it so late that... and it was a royal premiere, like most of the Bonds were. They delivered the title sequence very late, too late for it to be BBFC censored. They weren't called the BBFC, the British Board of Film Censors, or whatever they were called then.
Yeah.
So it's actually a sort of 15 opening sequence in an A film, because it's got full nudity.
It's got boobies in it, doesn't it?
It's got boobies. It's got more than boobies.
So it's got bum bums.
It's got personal columns. It's got boobies and bum bums and all sorts of bits when they're spinning around the gun barrels.
Yeah.
And I saw that very young, and jeepers creepers, it was inspiring.
Changed your life?
Certainly changed some of my nocturnal habits.
Wow.
changed my going to bed routine.
Started going to bed early.
It had a heavy impact on bath time, let's just say that. The sex scene in An Officer and a Gentleman.
Okay.
Sexy. Yeah. Hated each other, apparently.
Yeah.
That's what makes it more tired.
So sexy, yeah.
Name of the Rose.
Yeah, in a bun. In a church.
In a barn. In a castle. And it's one of those terrible female characters who's a sort of enfant sauvage, you know. Like, it's a terrible cliche, like the lead woman in The Fifth Element. You know, sort of... like a very attractive woman who can't speak or understand things.
But she
for some reason, this sort of type appears in a lot of films written and directed by men. Beth, okay, I'm going to teach you some things. It's a bit like that in The Name of the Road. She's just a sort of feral girl that lives off scraps outside the monastery and but happens to be very horny.
Mm.
Not sure how common that is. Anyway, she has it off with Christian's sooner or Slater. And then, okay, yeah, so the lover, Jean-Jacques Annaud,
Jane Marsh.
Don't say it like you don't know her name. Jane Marsh.
Jane Marsh.
The Sinner from Pinner.
Yeah, that's a wonderful film.
I saw that film with, I thought it was an art film, and I saw it with my best friend's girlfriend.
Yeah.
They'd been together for years. Mm. Like, so, hey, and we didn't go to the cinema a lot, but hey, do you want to, let's go and see The Lover. It's a film about, it's a film about love. It's a romantic film. And there's just like, there's a sex scene where he basically polishes the floor with her.
Mm.
Uses her sort of like a mop.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
It's a wonderful film.
It's a ridiculous
film. From start to end.
But I was very, it just was a very uncomfortable, and I eventually said, listen, we should go.
She was in a film which was considered a very bad film that I saw called Colour of Night.
Bruce Willis movie, yeah.
Seen that?
Yeah.
It's got lots of sex in it, which is great, but it also has her disguised as a boy.
Yeah. It's got Bruce's Willis in it.
It's got Bruce's Willis in it, in the bath.
Yeah.
With her. And there's like a twist that she was the boy in the group. But when you watch it, it's just her in a short wig.
Yeah.
And so when the twist comes, you're like, yeah, Jane Marsh in a wig. As she has been now.
No, I must rewatch it. You're making me want to rewatch
it. It's pretty good because also he's colorblind, which serves no story purpose at all.
Right, really? But it's what's it called?
Colour of Night.
The Colour of Money. The Colour of Night. That would be a good double bill.
Yeah. Now, I have to pick one from that list, don't I?
Oh, well, do you? Yeah. I thought that was it. I said everything I've got to say about them, really.
We can't just have all of them. We can only have one.
Oh, I've got to pick.
I'm giving you The Lover. You sold me on The Lover. It's made me want to watch it again. It sounds great. That's the guy who made The Bear, right?
Yeah.
He likes women and bears. Good luck to him.
That's the film he hasn't made yet. But she's very beautiful.
She is.
The Sinner from Pinner.
Where is she now?
Just in Pinner sinning. in a pinny.
As per. There is a subcategory to this question. I get nervous to ask some people this. I'm not nervous to ask you. Mark Homer told me off for this question, but it's staying. Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. A film you found arousing that you thought perhaps you shouldn't.
What is a wide-on?
It's where a lady is aroused.
All right. Really? Which film did you find arousing that you shouldn't? I don't really have a good answer for this because I don't feel shame.
That's great.
About that sort of thing. I mean, it is already, I'm not somebody who gets like finds Jessica Rabbit arousing.
Really?
I mean, I tell you what is troubling is Japanese erotic animation.
Mm.
You know, for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
When we Adam and I made a series called Adam and Joe Go Tokyo, where we stayed in, we lived in Tokyo for a few months, and we went to a cosplay convention where there were various famous animators. So we walked into this hall and there were little stands, very, very long queues, all of men and boys.
Yeah.
And you couldn't quite see what was on the stand, but there'd be big displays around the stand of very sexy cartoon girls with huge eyes, you know, slightly paedophilic, slightly dodgy stuff. And then so we'd have a look, who are they all queuing up for? And it would be just a big fat man signing the, and he said, well, there isn't a woman in this equation anywhere. It was very odd. So that stuff, for that reason, and for all sorts of reasons, I find, because there was a phase when that stuff, around the time that Akira was huge.
Yeah.
There was a phase where that stuff was a little bit illicit and exciting. But like Perfect Blue's quite good, actually.
Yeah.
But there's that stuff I find troubling. But then I don't find it very arousing.
You don't feel shame is really the key point here.
Well, animation is such a weird thing. To be like, it's just weird, isn't it?
It is weird.
It's just weird because it's not real, really.
But you don't feel shame in your life? Are you not embarrassed?
Well, I don't... Not really. I don't feel I've got an enormous amount to be ashamed about, apart from my early short films.
Do you get embarrassed? Do you suffer from embarrassment?
Well, I get embarrassed at my... I embarrass myself.
Right.
I mean, what have we been doing for the last hour?
Okay. What is the greatest film of all time, objectively?
It's very hard to answer this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think... I mean, what does that mean, great film? I mean, people say Citizen Kane, I suppose, because it has terrific technique, it embodies a life,
mm-hmm.
the acting's terrific, it's sort of ticking all the...
He predicted what he'd look like in the future, exactly.
There we go. It's ticking all the aspirational boxes, but it's so subjective, isn't it?
I guess the way I often put it for this question is, it might not be your favourite, because I don't think Citizen Kane is anyone's favourite film.
Well, that's what's weird about the question.
But it's more aliens come, they go, what's the pinnacle of cinema if we can only watch one?
If they, I'd give them a bunch or tell them to fuck off back to Mars.
Right.
I think it's...
They've come to Devon, they bounced around the back of your...
Well, then I'd say probably Lawrence of Arabia, but I'd want them to watch a 70mm print.
That's lovely. They'll
on a big, big old screen.
That's great.
That's a
great
really answer. Good, isn't it?
It is really good.
But it's not, you know, it's a film you watch, one watches every, like, 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a long one, but it's pretty amazing.
The aliens are like, we've only got 4 hours.
But then stuff like Alien, Die Hard, Terminator 2, The Shining, 400 Blows, you know, there are those movies that... Yeah. It's interesting when a new video format comes out, like 4K, the movies they...
Yeah,
that come
yeah.
out, I mean, Alien, Blade Runner...
Apocalypse
Now. Yeah, those are sort of
staples.
Yeah, they've got something actually, you know, because they've just released The Wizard of Oz. Lawrence of Arabia is available for streaming in 4K, but not on disc. Citizen Kane isn't, but Alien fucking is. Do you know what I mean?
Because
it's amazing.
It holds up.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
Alien's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, Alien is it's so good. I mean, I would die to have made Alien, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's fucking good.
It's such a good film. And to come at that moment where you're taking a... This is the key thing, to take a genre that hasn't been taken seriously and do it in a way that's... It's sort of what Joker's done to one extent or another, but to do it in such a human, grounded way is to just be at that level professionally, at that cultural moment, and have everything aligned to do that. Star Wars sort of did it, but to take a genre that's become dismissed and then just make it real, like Alien did, is such a key thing to do.
What is the film you most relate to? You've been waiting for this question.
I had a problem with Brat Pack movies when I was a teenager. You know when one is at one's most idiotic? It's probably 16, 17, 15, 16, 17. I was a dick. It's just a confluence of biological, social, hormonal, cultural influences. You're just awful. I was just awful. And you're very vulnerable to terrible things.
Yeah.
So I just, me and Adam and we were just hit between the eyes by, you know, St. Elmo's Fire and just fucking, I mean, that's not a great film, is it?
No. But were you like, that's us?
A little bit. I sort of want, we knew we weren't, but we wished it was.
Yeah.
Like I saw Top Gun in San Francisco long before my friends did, because I went on holiday to San Francisco.
Right.
And that was when there used to be a six-month window between American releases and British releases.
Yeah.
I was so jealous of all my friends who went to America the whole time and always came back to school and went, oh, I've seen this and that, and I couldn't see it for months.
Yeah.
I'd seen Top Gun ahead of time. I thought, right, I'm going to get a Top Gun jacket, and I'm going to rock that look before anyone else in the UK has. Now, they didn't sell the jackets or the little sew-on badges. So I bought just a bomber jacket. I couldn't, for love nor money, find any little US Air Force pin-ons.
Yeah.
So I drew them on in Tipex.
That's so good.
And I wore that jacket. Adam's got video of me in the London Underground with me wearing a faux Top Gun jacket with Tippex insignia on. No one knew the film existed. It's like, what, why has that spotty boy, why has he drawn, what has he drawn in Tippex? Tippex doesn't hold up well either on
cloth. Please, can you release this footage onto your Instagram?
Adam's got it.
Okay.
It's up to him.
What is the one film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Well, it's a very tough one, this again.
Because you've rinsed a lot.
Yeah, and you don't really want to do that, do you? Because you kind of kill them a bit. So I really don't know. I put The Black Stallion, but I'm not sure I could watch that over and over again. It's a really good movie, have. The Black Stallion. I've watched it a lot because it's sort of it's got adventure components with the amazing shipwreck sequence at the beginning. Then it's got a sort of nature documentary with the kid and the horse. Have you seen it?
I have, when I was a kid, yeah.
Which is so beautifully shot. It's the first film I saw on my own in the cinema, so made a big impression on me. Then it's got the bit I don't love is the Mickey Rooney training stuff in the middle, but even that's quite good.
Right.
And then it's got the amazing horse race sequence and the triumphant ending. Mm-hmm. Just the different the shooting techniques in it are really, really good. It's Terminator 2, I think I could watch a lot.
Yeah.
Like some of the best action sequences ever in terms of geography,
yeah.
Clarity, Raiders.
Yes, of course.
But even Raiders, if you watch it too much, you start noticing continuity errors and stuff like that.
How often do you struggle to watch a film, as in to just get lost in a film these days with your filmmaking brain?
Oh, no, it's fine.
Oh, good.
Yeah. No, I don't struggle
at all.
I'm
worried about you. Because you've said a few times, you notice this, you notice that.
I think it's just I'm 50, you know. So right. Movies I saw when I was a teenager, I've now been watching regularly for more than 30 years.
Hang about, you're 50?
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Well, you're in good nick.
Thank you. Very, 50? Very old, yeah. Born in December 68.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. There's no getting around it, Brett.
Shit.
Can't do anything about it. Might as well face up to it.
Okay. No, you don't like being negative, and I'm not, you know, we'll be quick, and I get it, you're absolutely right. Films are so hard to make, and any film is an achievement. So when we ask this question, we don't mean like, and it should be burned. We just go, it didn't work for us.
Okay.
But well done, you. What is the worst film you ever saw, other than Siegfried and Roy's Magical Box?
That's a
good film, as we've discussed.
Well, Masters of the Universe I went to see with Adam and Louis.
That is fair.
When we were at school, and we struggled.
Yeah.
We weren't big fans.
Right.
But we struggled. We thought maybe it wasn't as good as they hoped it was going to be. Louis didn't like it at all.
Really?
He's very intellectual. Didn't like it. So serious, man.
He's always been that way.
Give my regards to Broad Street, Paul McCartney film. I took a friend's... I babysitted a lot when I was a teenager, and I took a friend's son to see it. Anyway, he farted. So it was so pungent. The sort of fart only an 11-year-old can do. Mm-hmm. You know, really, really savage.
Yeah.
Piquant. Sort of thing. I don't know. That just really strong. And somehow the experience of the film and that smell... Yeah. Really, really.
I don't know that film. Paul McCartney directed it.
Yeah. No, he didn't direct it. It's a sort of concert movie come drama.
Oh, great.
It's not good. Someone to Watch Over Me. So
Deborah Winger? Tom Berenger?
Yeah. Is it Ridley Scott? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying the film is bad, but I was very ill when I saw it.
Okay.
And sometimes when you're ill and you watch a film... Your illness permeates the film.
You made the film ill.
And when you watch it again, it's carrying the virus.
Yeah.
So I can't watch
okay.
Someone to Watch Over Me because it'll give me flu.
That's fair.
The Sweetest Thing.
Which?
Cameron Diaz.
Oh, yes.
Sort of
being a
lady's answer to a lad's comedy.
Yeah. It's got the vagina song in it or something.
It's the penis song.
The penis song.
My penis. Your penis is too big to fit in here.
Hmm.
Is the chorus. I just struggle with that one. So that's my answer.
That's
to
good.
Your question.
That's good. What is the film that made you laugh the most? You're in comedy. You're a funny man. What's the funniest one to you?
Well, these are obvious answers, and these are times I remember like hysterically, yeah. Uncontrollably, like, you know, not a thoughtful laugh,
yeah,
but a proper muscle spasm. And it's not an original answer, but Spinal Tap, ABC Fulham Road, 1984, with my friend Omar.
You saw it at the cinema?
Yeah, when it first came out. And there were only two other people in there, because I remember, and they were kids, I remember telling them to shut up.
Really?
And it was quite an important moment, yeah, in my life, when I was old enough to tell someone else to shut up and not be worried about being stabbed. And when the Stonehenge model, mm-hmm. the miniature, that, we just absolutely killed ourselves. And then Hot Rod at the ArcLight Hollywood in 2007.
Really?
Probably High, with Edgar, and the bit where they're walking along and You're the Voice kicks in and the guy picks up the dustbin and throws it through the window. That made me crack up.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, Spinal Tap is the...
I like it a lot.
Is the,
what's that? That's Austin Powers, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's probably not allowed anymore.
Joe Cornish, what a fucking delight.
Well, thank you, Brett.
Thank you for doing this.
Not
and
at all.
Me over. When you... You were at a water park, right? And you were about to get on a slide, and someone says, you know, it's got a razor and it's infinite. And you
went, yes.
Do you know what? I'm not going on that one. You walked, you bumped straight into Tom Cruise in a wig, one of his acting wigs, and he bit you on the neck, turned you into a vampire.
Yes.
And you were like, bloody hell, I didn't see that coming. But you didn't mind it, actually, because you were interested in the future. You lived way past everyone you know, Adam, Louis, your wife, your baby, everything. You experienced finally in the year 3400.
I'm not sure, can vampires procreate? I don't think.
Don't they make babies that grow really quickly, like in Twilight or something?
I don't know. I've never seen Twilight.
I've followed this.
You use this plural, Twilights. I've never seen them.
Never seen the Twiglets.
No.
You got to the year 34,500 when Brexit finally happened.
Yes.
And you saw changing regimes, the state, you saw all sorts of things.
Yeah.
You saw flying cars, you saw the abolition of flying cars, you saw flying cars come back again for a bit, then the Concorde was around for a bit. You saw all stuff. You started to realise that life was entirely cyclical, and that even though the technology changed, people have remained the same. At that point, you got slightly disillusioned with the future, and you started travelling the world looking for Tom Cruise to kill you so that you could finally die.
Yeah.
And you went to Tokyo, and you found an anime festival, and there was a very, very fat man. He was the size of three rooms.
Mm.
He was signing pictures of boobies that he'd drawn out of his own head. And there was Tom Cruise sat at the back having a fruit corner with blood in one corner, yogurt in the big bit. He was just putting blood into the yogurty bit for a new taste sensation. And you said, Tom Cruise, with your acting wig on, I finally found you. Will you please bite me again so I may die? And he said, yeah, all right, now? And you said, yeah, here's as good as any place. And he bit you on the neck and he sucked out your blood and you died. And you collapsed on the floor. But as you fell on the floor, over in the corner over there, another very fat man said, I'm open for autographs. And he held up a picture of some big cartoon boobies. An entire room full of people stamped over your body to get to him. So your body was a fucking mess.
I'm dead, though, at this
You're
point.
Dead now.
Yeah.
But your body was trampled. It's in bits. Got bits of cardboard, bits of carpet, everything.
Mm.
I show up. Muggins here. Clean up
the
mess.
Old Muggins.
Scrape you up, but there's so much more of you than I thought because of all this shit that's happened with all the squashing about, right?
Yeah.
All the bits I'm picking up that are attached to you. Anyway, stuff you in the coffin. There's more of you than I'd planned for. So the coffin is absolutely stuffed.
Stuffed with corn sludge.
Cornish pasties everywhere. Mm. And there's only room in this coffin for one DVD. One Blu-ray? No, it's a DVD.
Man, I was wondering where this was going, and now I realise.
For you to take to the other side.
Right.
On the other side, there's movie night every night. One night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone?
Well, because when I read this on your email, what I was really concerned about was the technical setup
available.
Like, I'm disconcerted by the idea of DVD.
I know.
Am I allowed a 4K disc?
I think, listen, what
am
I've been
I
thinking
talking
is
about 720?
You hand the DVD to God,
yes,
and then she converts it into a project, into actual film. Cellular.
Okay, so I am watching a full quality,
yeah,
theatrical.
But she will,
so you're really
asking
me what movie?
Yeah.
This is sort of the same question as what's my favourite movie.
No, not necessarily. No. It's the film you're showing to everyone in heaven.
Oh, that I'm showing to everybody.
It's your movie night. When it's your turn.
Well, I want to read the room now. Like, what's the...
Louis Armstrong's there.
Right.
Ella Fitzgerald's there.
Oh, this is tough, isn't it? I mean, many an evening has gone by where you decide to watch a film and then 90 minutes later you're still deciding.
Mm.
So I'd probably go for... Well, I'd go for something short, because when you're watching films in big groups, it's good to go 90 minutes or less, because okay, you're going to have some lightweights with you.
Okay.
I'd go for something quite arresting and fun. So I'm thinking Evil Dead 2.
Lovely.
Or maybe Raising Arizona.
Lovely.
I think I would go for one of those. How long is Raising Arizona?
102 minutes.
Is it? 87... is the year. 94 minutes, yeah. 4 minutes will be credits.
Okay, that's
Raising cool. Arizona or Evil Dead 2. I'd probably go, because we're in heaven,
mm-hmm,
I'm just wondering how the satanic elements of Evil Dead 2 would play.
Mm.
Probably a sort of enjoyably foolish.
Yeah,
it's
it
got
would be
some
a bit
afterlife
like cheeky,
elements. But it also might be inappropriate enjoying the suffering of others, mm, if that sort of thing really was going on.
Yeah.
So I might go for Raising Arizona.
Raising Arizona it is.
Yeah.
Joe Cornish, you've been wonderful. Is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for or to listen to or to watch?
No, to plug. Not really, no. If you've got kids and they're between the ages of, say, 8 and 13 and they haven't seen Kid Who Would Be King, then show them Kid Who Would Be King, because...
I'd agree with that.
We tested that movie very thoroughly before it was released, mm-hmm, and it scored, you know, really highly across the board with all age groups, Brett.
Yeah.
But particularly with that age group.
8 to 13.
Yeah. Mm. Like, if you're 10, 11, it can really hit your sweet spot.
Yeah, that would be your favourite film.
I'd just like to recommend some films this year.
Please.
Beach Bum.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Okay.
Missing Link.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it enormously. Shazam, probably my favourite big studio movie of the year.
Wow.
Parasite.
Oh,
not the only person to say that's great. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Bit divisive, that movie. Mm. I've talked to some people who don't love it. I loved it. Knives Out.
Yeah.
Rian Johnson's new
good
movie.
Good, is it?
Excellent.
Oh, nice.
Like Joker a lot.
Yes.
The Irishman.
Love The Irishman. I haven't seen most of the ones you're saying yet, but I fucking love The
Transit.
Irishman.
Good European movie.
Right.
The guy
Yeah.
Phoenix, whatever it's called. Phoenix? Yeah, something like that. Capernaum. Did you see that?
No.
Really good.
It, yeah.
Ash is the Purest White. Mm-hmm. Chinese movie. Really good. Birds of Passage. Colombian movie about Colombian tribes that get involved in the marijuana business.
Nice.
Really good. Loro, the Pablo Sorrentino movie about Berlusconi.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking great. Piranhas, Italian movie about youth gangs in Naples. Just a few little tippity tips.
I saw Marriage Story.
Right.
Which will probably be in my top three of the year.
I bet.
I'm calling it early.
Also, the new season of On Cinema at the Cinema. Do you watch that? Tim Heidecker?
Oh, I love it.
Holy fucking shit, that's funny. I mean, you've really got to start from the beginning. Have you watched any of them?
Yeah, it's so funny. I love it.
And the trial and everything. And
I love both of them.
Greg Turkington.
Mm.
Amazing.
There's a thing, Tim and Brett have lunch. You ever watch that?
No.
Brett Gelman and Tim
Heidecker. Oh, I thought it was going to be you.
No. It's a two-part. Tim Heidecker and Brett Gelman have lunch. It's one of my favourite things.
I'll check it out. On Cinema, that's brought me so much pleasure over the last... however many years it's been going. It's so fucking funny.
Okay, Joe Cornish. What a fucking treat.
That was very enjoyable. Brett, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming to my house.
Thank you for having me, and I hope you have a lovely time in heaven. And
it's good. A shame, isn't it?
Hmm.
What are the methods of death? What have been your favourite methods of death on this podcast?
I think Ed Gamble fell down a hill really slowly and just kept sort of bumping into stuff as he fell.
But that's like torture.
Yeah.
That's actually going to kill you.
Yeah.
That's like death by a thousand cuts.
Oh dear, as he fell. Yeah.
What a spooky note to end on.
Good night. So that was episode 71. Get your tickets for the live show with Nish Kumar on December 19th at the BFI and head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 30 minutes of chat with Joe. Also, go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and write about the film that means the most to you and why it means the most to you. If you have a look, people have been doing that instead of leaving reviews. And I tell you what, the stories are cracking. They'll make you laugh, they'll make you cry. You'll love it. Plus, it helps numbers, means more people listen. I can keep making it. We can keep doing this forever and ever until the world explodes and we all die because of the world exploding and not knowing how to cope with that. Thank you so much to Joe for doing this. It meant a lot to me. It was really great. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Leiden for the artwork. And thank you, Xanthi Futter, for being my friend. Come join me next week where my incredible special guest will be a surprise. I haven't decided who it is yet. Ooh, but you know what? It'll be a good one. Has there ever been a bad one? No, there hasn't. So, in the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota #4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Hey there, all you lovely listeners. Let's dive into this latest release that is going to suck the life out of you in the best way possible. So listen up, because the Womanizer Next 3D Pleasure Air Stimulator, available from Pink Cherry, takes pleasure to a whole new dimension, literally. Imagine taking the speed and intensity of the original groundbreaking Pleasure Air technology combined with new Climax control so you can control even the depth of the airwaves. The 3D Pleasure Air technology offers a deeper, richer sensation that might just transport you to another universe of pleasure. The Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry, is the only toy that allows you to take complete control of your orgasm journey with fully customizable speeds, intensities, and depths. Made from soft touch silicone, a fully waterproof body, and smart silence technology, you can enjoy pleasure anywhere, anytime. So what are you waiting for? Ditch the dull and enjoy unparalleled pleasure from the Womanizer Next 3D, available from Pink Cherry. Visit pinkcherry.com and save an extra 20% off with code NEXT.